Thanks for tuning into Baxi's Musical Podcast. If you like what you hear today, be sure to subscribe to it, like it, share it with everyone you know, and if you could leave a big fat review, that would be fantastic. Also, make sure you check out Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for regular updates on what's coming up on upcoming episodes. Today, we're brought to you by Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram of Chicopee. Visit Metro's state-of-the-art dealership right now near BJ's and Big Y on Memorial Drive. Or visit MetroJeep.com and drive home in your brand new Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram today. Now let's get right into today's episode with Steve Kilby of The Church on Baxi's Musical Podcast.
What is it?
It's Baxi's Musical Podcast.
Resistance is useless.
Think about this for a minute. Most of the people who attempt to write songs never get around to recording them, and those that do don't always get to the point where they release an album full of the other songs that they wrote, and those that have don't usually get the chance to write and record 27 more of them, full of even more songs. Occasionally, though, there are artists and bands that do, and some of them even enjoy cranking out a hit from time to time as well, but most of them don't. Unfortunately, that's often how it goes, but for the very select few, occasionally you'll stumble across writing a song that may not feel like much of a hit when you wrote it, but for whatever reason, it becomes a huge breakthrough all over the world. So much so that it's still being played 36 years later. This is exactly what happened in 1988, when a band from Australia known as The Church released their fifth studio album called Starfish. And thanks to the single Under the Milky Way, it would become a commercial success in the US, Canada, the Netherlands, New Zealand, the UK, and at home in Australia. 20 more albums would follow, and by their own admission, Under the Milky Way wasn't even their best song. Far from it. My guest today is Steve Kilby, who's not only the lead singer of The Church, he's also the primary songwriter for each of the band's 26 albums. On top of that, he's also released more than 30 solo albums as well. It's an incredibly impressive catalog of music, and Steve has shown absolutely no signs of stopping anytime soon. Last month, The Church released their latest record, Eros Zeta and the Perfume Guitars. In June, The Church kicks off their U.S. tour along with the Afghan Whigs, and they'll be bringing that tour to the Royal in Boston on June 21st. This is my conversation with Steve Kilby from The Church on Baxi's Musical Podcast. Congratulations on the new record. It's hard for me to imagine that you're now like 26, 27 albums deep. That's remarkable to me. So congratulations on that.
Thank you, mate. You know, there's more than that.
Oh, I know.
When people go, wow, you've made 27 albums. It's probably more like 37 albums when you think of there's all these albums that don't get tallied into that.
But on top of that, you've also got dozens and dozens of solo records too. It's a remarkable amount of work. Just like, you know, when do you take breaks?
That's a good question. The other day, about 2 weeks ago, I had some spare time and I went in the studio and banged out another EP. And it really did occur to me. Seriously occur to me, man, you need some time off, you know? So yeah, I've been going really hard for a long time, and I've got a gig next week in Sydney, but I am having a little bit of time off right now, but it's always percolating, you know, all this stuff. I've certainly, if I stopped making music, I've certainly, if I was to stop and not make any more records, I've certainly done my bit.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
That you have. I was listening to the new record, and it's an absolutely beautiful record. And I know that it's kind of like a companion piece to the last record, Hypnagogue, which was a concept record that came out in, I believe, February of last year. I had heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but there was some rumor that Hypnagogue was going to be the final Church album, and then all of a sudden there's another addendum to the concept. Is there any truth to that? Was there some thought that might have been the last record?
I think when you get to my age, I know that's a a hell of a cliched way to start a sentence, but I think any album could be your last. And I never anticipated that Hypnagogue was going to go over so well. It was kind of more a, I think, thinking it was the last album if it didn't get any, if no one was interested and didn't, no one thought we were barking up the right tree. It could have been. I think I would have been too disillusioned to keep on going, but
it was very widely praised, and it is a, it's an excellent record, and it's like it seems to me that if you've got something and it's getting that kind of recognition, you know, it would have been a great way to go out. But obviously, there's more to the story. There's more to the plot line of that concept record that must have come to you. I mean, how quickly did you start considering, hey, there may be more to this story?
Well, okay, so when we finished the Hypnagogue, there were a couple of tracks left over. And then we got these new managers in California. And the first day we met them, they said, hey, is there any more of the Hypnagogue? And I'm like, what do you mean? They're going, we could do a digital deluxe if you have an extra six tracks. And I said, okay, well, we've got some left over and we'll go in a studio. And then when we went in the studio, we were so prolific. We got we're just going to do another four or five tracks. We got another 13 tracks.
Wow.
So it's kind of serendipity that these guys, there hadn't been planned to be another one. But when these guys said to me, hey, there should be more, it just seemed like a wonderful idea. And then they said, oh, if only there was a book to go with it. And I went, well, strange you should say that, because I've started working on the book as well. So, but the second album and the book would never have come if the reaction across the board hadn't been so good. So I guess if you have success, you're not going to stop. You know, it's like you could be sitting at a river fishing and you go, if I don't catch a fish in the next 5 minutes, I'm going home. And then you catch one and then
they're there all day.
If they're biting, boy, you're going to stay there until they've stopped biting. So I guess that's how it is in the music industry.
I go back to the church almost 40 years. I think I bought this many years ago. I bought my own copy of Heyday. It's in excellent condition. And like we said, it's an enormous amount of work that you've created over, you know, 1,000 songs, you know, solo records, collaborations. I mean, just a lot of stuff. You make it seem like it's so easy. So like when a management team says, do you have more? And all of a sudden you're popping out 12 more songs. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, for most songwriters, coming up with one good song is a challenge. But I mean, are you constantly feeding this well of creativity, and how are you managing that?
Well, it's strange. I just read this book about Paul Simon, and he, who's one of my favorite songwriters, he apparently didn't, years and years will go past where he didn't write anything, and he would still feel angry and worried about not writing stuff. That never happened to me. I don't know. I just, at some stage, I sort of unlocked my creativity, and I found it is always there if I need it. I mean, if someone rang up and said, Steve, I want a really fucking good song by the end of the day about Paris, in waltz time with a mandolin, I could do it. If someone said, I want this or that or an article or a poem or a, I think I could do it. I'm not very good, but sort of, there's a trade-off, is I'm not very good at many things, and most things make me really angry and confused, especially modern day stuff, you know, like, you know, when you go to a restaurant and you can't just order from a waiter and you've got to, you've got to create an account. You've got to create an account to order your meal. And then you're like, oh, and then they're going, no, that password's no good. I'm like, what the fuck? I just want to order my dinner. So Yeah, the modern world, just all practical things make me, you know, like doing ordinary things I'm not very good at. I'm not very good at anything, but I'm, when it comes to writing songs or words, I can just do it. I don't know how people get this writer's block. It just seems to me there's so many different ways to write a song. And of course, I enjoy collaborating with all the people that I collaborate with. And some of them come to me, they've already got the music. And they're like, here's the music. Can you just sing something on top of that? That's really easy when the music's already written. But I don't know, I've just spent my whole life working on this. Like, right, you know, when I was 10, I was writing songs in my head, and I was listening to music, but I was, you know, like most kids would be listening to music when we were children. They weren't thinking about how it was created, but I was always intrigued by that part. And I was always intrigued, you know, I'm a sort of a, like an expert on songs. Yeah. I love songs. Yeah. I love songs. I love thinking about what is a song? What constitutes a song? What can a song do? A song can do anything. It's the most marvelous thing. It doesn't have to make any sense. It doesn't have to have any rhyme or reason. Literally, it doesn't have to have rhyme. I was surprised when I read in the Paul Simon book, he was talking about that song America, and he goes, not one rhyme in the whole fucking song. And he's right.
He's right.
There's no, it's like a really popular and famous song, and there's no rhyming in it. So songs can... I don't know, I've just become a songwriter. Always writing, always looking. I'm always analyzing. If I'm sitting on a bus and I can hear a conversation behind me, I'm listening to what they're saying and going, can I recontextualize their conversation into song lyrics? I'm always listening for things. I'm always trying to find new fields to plow.
In the case of Paul Simon, you're talking like you're not only just a great writer of melody, but he's also an outstanding lyricist too. Do you find that comes as easy as writing melodies for songs, or is it really two totally different type of talents?
It's like if you're a baseball and cricket, you know, you got a bat and you got a bowl, and they're really different things, and yet they are connected. I think, to me, it's easier to write music. It's easier to write lyrics than music.
Hmm.
Lyrics are easy to come by for me. And when I first started writing songs, I used to write the lyrics first, and then I'd try to fit music to that. And I find that is not the best way to do it. I find it's better to create music, or to have someone create music. And then once that's created, the music always suggests what the words would be, rather than sitting down with a piece of paper and going, I'm going to write these words down and they're going to become the lyrics for a song that I haven't written yet. I find that's a bit like the tail wagging the dog. And I've found that it's better for me to have a piece of music which will tell me what the lyrics want to be. But neither of them, I don't know, it's just a sort of a... When I couldn't write songs, when I wasn't very good at writing songs, when my songs were awful, like back in teenage days when I was struggling, it seemed like songwriting was a mysterious, this hard thing to penetrate. But I don't know, now I feel like I can do anything I want to do with it. But that's all I am good at. So I spent my whole life doing that.
I've talked to many songwriters, and a lot of them say it's kind of like a blessing and a curse, a blessing in the fact that they can do it, but a curse in the sense that they don't have a whole lot of control over it when they want to write a song, that sometimes they have to wait for the song to really kind of present themselves to them. And that's how they proceed. It sounds like these things are just coming through you rather than you chasing after it. Or am I misunderstanding what you're trying to say?
No, that's true. I could write a song right now. If I wanted to, I know I could. I know I definitely could pick up a guitar, I could smoke a joint, and I could write a fucking song if I wanted to right now. So I never struggle with it. I'm not waiting for anything, and I never get defeated by it. I would never start working on a song and go, I can't finish this, or I don't know what I'm doing. I would always finish it. During COVID, I made an album called 11 Women, and I was doing these shows on Instagram, and I was going back and learning all these old albums to play on Instagram. And one day I thought to myself, it's easier to write new songs than have to go back and figure out and remember these old songs. And I said to the people who are watching me on Instagram, this time next week, I'm going to have a brand new album ready. And then the next day, my girlfriend said, well, that's interesting. What are you going to do? And I went, it's all right. And Tuesday came, Wednesday came, Thursday came and went. And she said, boy, I'm tell you, I don't have a lot of confidence in this. And I went, all right, I'm going to start. And that day I wrote 5 songs. I went, fuck it. I smoked the joint. I picked up the guitar and I wrote 5 songs, and they were good. Yeah. They were good songs. I just need the merest sniff of an idea and I'm off and running. But like, I don't know. I have a relationship with my creativity. I don't want to sort of over dramatize it or make more of it than it really is, but I have a really healthy relationship with it. And it's kind of, as long as I'm using it to do something that I think is worthy and good, it's an unending flow. If I try and turn it towards something I don't really want to do, for example, I met these guys one morning in a sauna in Sydney. That's a bad way to start a sentence. I was in a sauna and at the swimming pool, and these guys came in, and they were from some big sort of disco's the wrong word. They were an electronic dance music band. And they went, Steve Kilby, how would you like to work on one of our tracks? And I went, all right, send it to me. And I went home and I rang my then manager. I said, have you heard of this band? And he went, oh my God, they sell fucking millions of records. You've got to do it. I went, all right, I will. Don't worry, you know me, I can write a song. The piece of music came, and it was so insipid. It was so nothing that I couldn't force. I was saying, all right, songwriting power, get onto this. We've got to work on this song. Doesn't matter, you know. And the thing was like, nah. I said, come on, focus on this. Come on, we've got to write this song. These guys, I couldn't do it.
Really?
I would put the piece of music on, and 4 minutes later, when the music finished, I was sort of looking out the window going, boy, that's an interesting cloud. And so I found out there, and I find out all the time. So I guess what I'm trying to say, to simplify it all, I can only work on things I'm interested in. So someone could go, oh, wow, you know a lot about music. You could be a great record producer. And then they would get me in the studio and they would find out if I wasn't interested in what they were doing or what we were doing, I was hopeless. So I guess I can only work on things I'm really interested in. It won't just kind of keep ticking over if I don't think it's something special. That's the caveat with that thing.
I've been reading a couple interviews with you and listening to a few along the last couple of weeks, and it occurs to me when you're a guy who has written so prolifically, you know, and like I said, over 1,000 songs, maybe even, you know, many more than that. When you have that much work behind you, and you perform live, and the expectation is you're only going to get to 20 of the songs that everybody knows. That's an interesting relationship you have with your older songs. And I know for some artists, and not just you, the idea of going back and regurgitating some of those older things when there's so much new stuff to consider, it's a tough love-hate relationship with your own work.
Yeah. And, you know, when the church is getting ready for a gig, and, you know, we have we can play, as you say, 20 songs in a night. There's, you know, 500 songs. It means a lot of them aren't ever going to get played.
Right.
And then there's a lot of songs that you're sort of obligated that you have to play that the audience won't like it if you don't, you know, in Australia, there's at least four or five songs we have to play, you know, or people are going to, why you didn't play blah, blah, blah. And so, yeah, it's hard knowing what to do. And I do like playing my newer songs better than my old ones. There's some old ones I still have affection for. I don't mind. But yeah, all those songs that, and there's a lot of arguments, you know, in the band, you know, about what people want to play and what we're going to do. And yeah, the more songs you have, the less time you have to play them all, I guess.
I mean, I would think that, you know, when you have like an international hit, like, you know, for example, Under the Milky Way, you know, that's something that the expectation is you're always going to play that. That's one of those songs that, you know, here in the States, it's still being played. To this day, that is a song that has a substantial life. And you know, not everybody gets a chance to do that. I mean, is that one of those songs where you say, oh my God, I have to do this one more time. I'm gonna go crazy.
Yeah, it's one of those songs I have to play no matter what configuration I'm in or who I'm playing with or where I am. If it's big or small or someone's hired me for their birthday party or whatever, I got to do that one.
Yeah.
And I have made my peace with that. And I also feel like if you do have to do a song, I'm glad it's that one. I'm glad it's not some weird novelty hit that I have to pull out and sort of embrace. So, yeah, but when you have one hit song, you've got to play it,
yeah,
for sure.
When you came out with Starfish and that song winds up hitting, and in Reptiles, another song that I really, really enjoy a lot. I know for a lot of people, when they hit success or they hit it, they get that one hit or commercial breakthrough, there is a lot of focus and attention on trying to duplicate that success. And that's simply not an easy task. In fact, most of the time, it's impossible. Did you find after releasing that song that that expectation was prevalent for you? Did you feel an extra sense of pressure to recreate that?
People tried to apply the pressure on me. People in the record company, Arista, obviously. I mean, if I had a record company and I signed someone up and they had a hit, I would be going, hey, can't we have another one like that? I mean, it's just economics. And it seems really obvious that, oh, just write another one like that. But I didn't know how to. I didn't know how to write another one like that. That's the hard thing. The hard thing isn't writing a song. The hard thing is writing a song like another song. That's a really hard thing to do. To write another, that was a very hard assignment for me, which obviously I couldn't embrace. Write another song that's like that, that isn't like that. It's like that sort of stuff can drive you mad. And I couldn't write another one like that. And it amused me that the people in record companies think that I'm a difficult guy who could write hits if I wanted, but because of some sort of stupid churlishness, I won't do it just for the sake of it. So that was a funny episode when they were all going, you've got to write another one like that. And so, yeah. That's very obvious. It would be nice to have another one like that. But with all my songwriting ability, I have yet to write another song like Under the Milky Way. Right. I don't think I could. I don't think even if someone said, I'm going to give you $1 million if you can write another song that's like Under the Milky Way. I don't know how to do it. I don't know. That's the trouble.
You wouldn't attempt Under the Milky Way again.
Yes.
I mean that would be virtually impossible, I think, for any songwriter to do and do successfully without making it sound like it's trite or cliched because you tried it.
Well, the Beatles managed it for about 3 years. You know, when they had She Loves You and I Want to Hold Your Hand and Help and all those songs, they all kind of sounded like each other. But they were all different,
yeah,
and they all had the same kind of sound, and it was the same idea. And yet they managed to make song after song after song that was kind of like the last one, but not like the last one. And I really got to take my hat off to that, that they managed to, you know, someone said, oh, she loves you. Can you do another one like that? And bang, they've got, I Want to Hold Your Hand. It's like it, but it isn't like it. But I, yeah, so they could do it. I think some of the early church, I think the jingly jangly songs I used to write, I could definitely do more of them. If someone said to me, can you write like an early church song for us now? I could go, yeah, I could do that. But there's something about Under the Milky Way that remains elusive. I don't know what the bit is that everybody likes, and that's why it's really hard to do. So I've just left it alone. And when people used to say to me, you've got to write another one, I would just kind of ignore them and go, you don't understand. It's not going to happen like that.
The U.S. has been very receptive to the church over the years. I know you've had a lot of decent times here, and I've heard from a number of other Australian artists that as big of a country as it is, you're really talking about an area that's got like five or six major cities, and you can literally tour Australia in a week. When you're there and this is before on the Milky Way, and before you start going to say the UK and coming to the States, it sounds like Australia, as vast as it is a very isolated body of land that if you don't get out of Australia, then it's really hard to have a very successful career musically. Is that true? And did you find that also be the kind of a restrictive? Did you need to get out of Australia?
Oh, you got to get out. There are some really big stars in Australia that don't get out. They never got out, but they're big enough that they're making a lot of money. And, you know, whenever they play, there's thousands and thousands of people and their records sell. If you can pull that off, you don't have to leave. But if you're like a band like the church, we had to leave.
Yeah.
We had to get out. The question was, where were we going? Back in the early 80s, there were two paths. There was critical acclaim and hunger and poverty and struggling in London, or there was not critical acclaim, but going to LA and not starving and not struggling and sort of living the good life. And I know a lot of bands who did both. And I know a lot of bands who only did just one or the other. The church had a bit of a crack at London in 1982 before we came to America. And we went over there and found that the English and the Europeans really liked us. And then 2 years later, we came to America, and that really worked out. There's no way we could have kept on just being a band in Australia. As you say, there's four or five big, what you would call a big cities, and then that's it. And look, I'm English anyway, not that that's got anything to do with it. I was born in England, but I need vindication from the rest of the world. I couldn't have just done this in Australia and been happy. You've got to get out. We had to get out.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad we did, and I'm so glad we still get out and we still have a chance to get out. Every time I land in America to do a big tour, I'm like, thank you, that I get the opportunity to do this.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, no, it's absolutely necessary.
So I remember working in radio back in the 80s, and I remember a lot of things that came along with that, and many of the details of the 80s and into the 90s are pretty hazy or lost in a blackout. In the music industry in particular, there was a lot of temptations, a lot of things thrown at you, especially when you talk about going to America and Los Angeles and New York, and there's a lot of chemical
yep.
distractions going on at the time. And I know
yep.
that is certainly something that you had been through and had struggled through. Tell me about being exposed to that stuff for the very first time here in the States. I mean, I don't know if you had the same kind of exposure in Australia, but I know here in the States, I mean, it was everywhere.
Although, I don't know, this is hard to talk about. I do like cocaine. But I never, it was never my downfall. It never got me by the balls the way it did other people.
Right.
Nor did alcohol. Unfortunately, it was heroin that got me, which I did in Australia. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, a lot of musicians, not all musicians, said there would be musicians say, I'm not in it for girls and drugs. But the girls and drugs weren't the only thing the church were in it for. In our younger days, we certainly enjoyed the kind of benefits of all of that stuff. And it's easy to lose yourself.
Yeah.
And you can lose focus on what's really happening. But, you know, some people take it like David Bowie took the cocaine and the groupies, and he made great song. If you listen to Aladdin Sane and,
sure.
You know, Diamond Dogs, he did something with that because it's a world of its own, all of that stuff that you have to negotiate. So, it's a pitfall. It's a trap for young players. You know, you've got to enjoy it. You've got to not get too wound up in that whole thing.
It is a trap, and there are, you know, inherent dangers in it, you know, life-threatening dangers in a lot of ways. But you, the Bowie example is actually a very good one because, like Bowie, you stayed functional during that time.
Yes.
I mean, many people cannot, and they, you know, completely, you know, lose their ability to, you know, connect with the world or with their talent or with, you know, in this case, music. But you stayed functional during all of that.
I did. Functional. That's a good word. Yeah, I wasn't. I was functional. I made music despite the drugs, but still, it was a struggle. I'm very lucky. I was a functioning addict, and I still made records. And yeah,
yeah. How did you find your way through all of that? Obviously, you know, it's not a simple thing. But I mean, you seem to be on the other side of it.
Yeah. Well, a long time ago, I was an addict from 90 till 2000. And I randomly and bizarrely became an addict when I never thought I would have been. And then when my time was over, the universe, and, you know, whatever you think the universe is, and I'm leaving that open, the universe looked at me one day and it said to me, you're free. It's over now. You've done your time. You've learned your lesson. It's all over. And it was. And I guess people got saved by the grace of God. I got let off the hook. That doesn't happen for other people. There were people who I was using with that I still see, and they're still using. Their whole life still revolves around, you know, scoring and shooting and getting more money and scoring and shooting. It's the be all and end all of, I tell you what, if you've got that in your life, you don't need anything else. It's the answer to every question. And the question for every answer is, how am I going to get the money? And how am I going to find the first, you wake up in the morning and you got to find the money, and then you got to find the stuff. And some mornings, yeah, the money's there and the stuff is there and you know where it is. Other mornings you wake up, there's no money and no stuff. But you can't say, oh, I'll have a day off today. You know, it's like, it doesn't work like that. You can't go, oh, it's going to be too hard to find it. I was just very lucky. I was lucky that I drifted in and I drifted out. And it doesn't work like that for everyone. All of the traditional things didn't work for me. Methadone didn't work. NA didn't work. Rehab didn't work. None of that stuff could penetrate this hold that this shit had on me. It's like I was just obsessed. And then one day it lifted. In NA and AA, they go, if you keep working at it, the obsession will lift. And you'll be free again. And I was lucky enough for that to happen. But I don't recommend anybody who's looking at me and going, wow, you can get into that and get out again. Look at him. He's all right. It's like, yeah, I'll tell you, I have so many problems with this now. When I go and have a blood test, I haven't got any veins. I haven't got a vein on my fucking body. They have to go into my groin. You know, I had to have a thing looking at my heart. There's no way, you know, the other guys, they just put it up their arm, but I don't have any veins in my arms anymore. So I have to, so when people take blood from me or putting an IV drip in my body and stuff, I fucked all that up. And I've still, I'm still living in the financial mess of it all too. Mm-hmm. I lost everything I had during those days. I squandered everything. I put it all up my arm. And then I still haven't financially recovered from that. And that was 25 years ago now.
Yeah.
A quarter of a century. I'm still struggling with the mess I made of my life. So I, like, I really don't recommend it. And I really don't recommend, while we're on this subject, there's only one drug I recommend, and that's marijuana. That's the one. Never lets you down. You might get the munchies. Mm-hmm. You might have a bit too much and have a bit of a freak out, but, you know, it never comes back and bites you on the ass. And I find that's the thing that helps me create. Smoking dope, I write songs, and I think marijuana was made for music. I read an article the other day, they're looking at people's brains, and they would play them their favorite song, and then they would be monitoring their brains, and they're listening to their favorite song, but like 60% of their brain is elsewhere. They can watch, instead of listening, and then they give them the marijuana, and then they see that 100% or close of the person they can see in their brain activity is listening to the music. So something about the way marijuana works is sort of like, it's very conducive to listening to and making music.
And certainly there's medical benefits to it as well. I mean, you know, I live in Massachusetts. It's a recreational marijuana state. We get dispensaries all over the place. There is great upside to the legalization of it, you know, for many, many people. I mean, it's really helped people survive all kinds of, you know, physical and
totally
mental difficulty. I mean, it really has had a remarkable benefit.
It is. One final thing on this. I have a friend who lost both his legs in an accident, and he was on endone and fentanyl and ketamine. They couldn't stop the pain, and then he met a doctor who prescribed him this certain type of weed, and he said it's the best pain relief he's ever had.
Yeah.
Much more relieves the pain much more than any opioids ever did. So yeah, it's a marvelous thing, and it has so many uses. It's the only thing I really, if you want to write a song, I'd say. If people come to me and say, how do you write a song? I say, number one, smoke a joint. And that will certainly get you in the mood.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, because I was really kind of digging deep into like your website and stuff, is your artwork. And I was on the website, thetimebeing.com, and it's really excellent work. And, you know, in spite of everything you've done, I asked you early on, how do you get the time to do that? Artwork included. I mean, there's a lot of work that you've done, and it's wonderful.
Well, you know, you wake up in the morning, you do a bit of painting, you strum a guitar, and you go down the studio, and you know, I don't have anything else to do. It's not like anybody's waiting for me to change their light bulb or go and deliver the newspaper. Because painting isn't work. You know, and writing music isn't work. That's why we call it playing. We play music. So I like all these pursuits that don't involve real work. Because I had a few jobs. I had some jobs in my younger years. I really didn't like it. So you know, doing a bit of painting and, you know, strumming a guitar isn't really work.
Yeah.
It's more like a paying hobby, isn't it?
The church is coming back to the States in June, and in fact, you'll be in Boston on June 21st at the Boston Royale, along with the Afghan Whigs. What a great bill that is. How did that come to be?
Well, I was a big fan of Greg Dooley, and he apparently was a big fan of mine, and I said as much to whoever would listen. And one day he turned up at a show in LA and we met up and we got on pretty well. And he actually came to Australia and we wrote a couple of songs together. We were kind of sort of good friends. And I don't know, I guess that's what made it all easier.
Yeah.
And then I'm not sure if our managers approached his or his approached ours, but they started, this has been being talked about for a long time now. So it's great that it's all coming to fruition. But I guess because of our friendship Greg and I had, and we worked together, and I really like his music and he likes mine, I guess that makes it all easier than, you know, going on tour with somebody you don't know or someone who you're not sure if you like their music or not.
Right.
So I suppose the tour has its roots in our friendship.
It sounds like it's going to be great. The new album is Eros Zeta.
You think so? Yeah.
And the Perfume guitars. Steve, it's a real pleasure to talk to you. I've been an admirer and a fan for a long time, and it's great to have you tonight.
Thanks, Baxi.
See you soon. You bet. The name of the new album from Steve Kilby and the Church is called Eros Zeta and the Perfume Guitars, and their North American tour is about to kick off, including a stop in Boston on June 21st. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. Feel free to follow it, like it, share it, review it too. You can email me at bax@rock102.com. I'd love to know what you think. Thanks to Metro Chrysler Dodge Jeep and Ram of Chicopee, and thanks to you for listening to Baxi's Musical Podcast.